Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Law, Denise Howell, Episode 63, Pink Floyd Semantics.
This Week in Law is brought to you by Audible. For your free audiobook, visit audiblepodcasts.com/TWiT.
Hi, this is Denise Howell, and you're here for TWiT 63, This Week in Law, my favorite time of the week. I hope it's one of yours, too, where we get together with very smart people and some old friends of mine from time to time and chat about the technology law issues that affect all of our lives, whether you're a little kid or someone in their 80s just getting an iPad for the first time. This sort of stuff affects all of us and is important. So we're really thrilled to have the chance to get together with Evan Brown. Evan, welcome back to the show.
Hey, well, thanks for having me. I think it's my favorite time of the week as well. So great to see you. And it's going to be a great time today.
Great to see you too. Folks, you can find Evan at internetcases.com, where he blogs about all things related to the internet and the law. And someone else who does much of that too is Jonathan Bailey. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Denise. Glad to be here. It's great to be back.
Great to have you back. Jonathan, you can find online at plagiarismtoday.com. And he also does a podcast on copyright issues called Copyright 2.0. Where can folks find that, Jonathan?
You can actually find it on Plagiarism Today or copyright20.com.
Wonderful. And who's your co-host there?
Co-host is Patrick O'Keefe of the iFroggy Network and iFroggy.com. He's an excellent community guy. He comes at it from the both as the music blogger side and as a community admin, too. He brings a lot of interesting, I guess you would say, in the trenches perspective on this stuff.
Fabulous. Well, it's great to have you back on the show. We're also waiting for one other panelist to join us. That is Nikki Black. She is a lawyer and blogger and podcaster herself and has lots of good insights on all things related to internet law and criminal law and all sorts of things. We're having a little technical difficulty getting her on. So as soon as we are able to iron out her Skype issues, she will be joining us too. So stay tuned and we hope to get Nikki on very shortly here, but didn't want to delay too much in starting the show. Hey, there's Nikki. Are you able to hear us and can we hear you? Oh, not yet. All right, we're going to have to keep trying to iron out Nikki's technical issues, and we'll get rolling. First, I wanted to chat with Jonathan about something that got posted to Plagiarism Today. Thought it was a pretty interesting notion of how you might communicate in today's world and how traditional legal communications might be altered by some of the social media things people are involved in. Jonathan, you had written about whether you would send a cease and desist order over Twitter or Facebook, or a cease and desist letter, which basically just asks someone who you think is violating your legal rights in one way or another to stop that. What do you think about all that?
Well, a cease and desist letter or cease and desist notice, you know, it's not a formal legal document that it doesn't have to be served and so forth. But still, it's typically best to deliver it through some kind of more, you know, verifiable chain in case this case does have to escalate further, especially escalate into a courtroom. But really, the whole discussion started with a someone I was working with. I was helping them track down contact information. And I was initially having a little trouble. I eventually found some good business contact info for them, but it started out I was having a lot of, you know, bad luck with it. But I was able to find Twitter and Facebook accounts for the guy, and I kind of jokingly suggested we contact this person that way. I laughed the idea off, but then I started researching it, and I found there were actually two cases recently, one in the UK in which an impersonator was served legal papers via a tweet on Twitter. and a December 2008 case, and there have been others since, I am sure, that involved an Australian couple that was sued, that was served legal paperwork via Facebook in a loan dispute. So it didn't seem that outrageous, and I was wondering, since it's become very acceptable today to send these notices via email, which is a method of communication that didn't exist, you know, in, within many people's lifetimes, if maybe social networking is going to become a way to send these still very legal in nature, but still perhaps not quite requiring full service legal communications. My initial thought was I don't see it happening yet, but I'm definitely wondering what we're going to be like in 15, 20 years.
Evan, what do you think about this? I tend to agree with Jonathan that however you communicate, as long as you have a verifiable way of showing that you've done so, would be effective in getting this point across. You might have to do some education to a court to convince them that you've actually managed to reach this person. But if you're doing it in the same context as the activity is taking place, that seems to me to be a pretty valid way of going about it. What do you think?
I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with trying to place somebody on notice like this. If you think about the mechanics of actually doing it, I guess you would send them a DM or an at reply in Twitter, for example, with a link, and then that link would have a document that you download that contains the letter. I guess, or what I'm assuming is that you're not going to spell out your theory and demand that they cease and desist within 140 characters. So the mechanics aside, I would avoid doing this, you know, at least the state of things are right now. I mean, it's obviously a kind of an interesting conversation to be having and interesting to talk about. And I think we're all on the in agreement here as to whether or not we should do it. The two reasons that I wouldn't do it, the first one being, as Jonathan correctly pointed out, a cease and desist letter is not, you know, an official legal document, requiring service of process under the rules or whatever. But yeah, that doesn't mean that cease and desist letters don't have a legal effect. One of the biggest things that I think.
Plug it in. Oh, well, we can hear you, Nikki.
That's a good sign.
That's a good sign.
Yes.
Thank you.
Emerging from the murky other side of things here. I mean, cease and desist letters definitely can have a legal effect. The biggest one that I think about when I'm sending one, which is usually in the context of intellectual property infringement, you know, if I'm representing a plaintiff who is accusing someone else of infringement, is it pertains to the question of willfulness, especially with copyright infringement and in trademark infringement too. If you can demonstrate that somebody infringed willfully, you have the opportunity to get greater damages in the event it is to go to trial. So the question of willfulness can be shown more clearly if the infringement continues after having been put on notice, for example, through a cease and desist letter. So it's for that reason that you want to make sure that it's provable, that it's demonstrable that the letter was sent. And you know, it just seems like an extra layer of complexity to have to educate the court as to how it was sent through this tweet.
Great.
And everybody's gonna laugh. The other legal effect that a cease and desist letter can have is an electronic discovery issue. You want to make sure that it's, again, demonstrable that the other side was put on notice and that they reasonably apprehended that litigation was imminent, so that if there's destruction of electronic or any kind of evidence, whether it be electronically stored information or paper documents, you have a better claim for spoliation if you want to go down that road trying to play the play gotcha with your opponent. The other main reason, so there's one, these things have a legal effect, and so that's why I would avoid doing it in kind of a cutesy kind of way through social media. The other reason that I would avoid doing this right now is because of the mythological or the psychological effect that a more formal letter has, you know, received by either FedEx or return receipt, certified mail return receipt requested or something like that. You know, I think that if you're going to send a communication in a rather offhand way through social media, that may not be taken as seriously by its recipient. Right. As what one would, you know, when somebody actually delivers a tangible thing to your door. It's kind of the same thing. You know, there's a certain mythological sense in many things of the law. You know, I mean, why is it that judges wear black robes and they sit on a bench higher than everyone else? It's because there's a certain respect, a certain decorum that is instigated by that or, you know, brought elicited by that. Same thing, getting a cease and desist letter on fancy thick bond paper that required some effort to have it transmitted to its recipient. So those are the two main reasons I would just stick with the old fashioned way for now.
Well,
yeah, being the operative word, as you were talking, yeah. I was sort of envisioning people getting a telegram, you know, telling them that they need to comply with something. And maybe in the olden days, that would have happened as the speediest way to communicate. But I can't really see that happening now.
And you could have saved a lot of money sending it by telegram because, you know, they used to charge by the word. And at least in the movies, every sentence in a telegram ends with the word stop. So with a cease and desist letter, say you could just only have to pay for the words, we hereby request that you immediately, you only have to pay for those because then the stop is put in for free. So,
or it could just be stop. Right. Hey, Nikki, are you there?
I am.
Yay, we've got Nicole Black. Let me go ahead and introduce you and have you chime in on what we've been talking about. Folks, this is the lovely and brilliant Nicole Black. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. Glad to be back.
Great to have you. Where can folks find you? I'm not going to ask where folks can find all of your various blogging and online efforts because there are too many to mention, but you have one central place that can funnel people out to your various activities. And what would that be?
Probably NicoleBlackESQ.com might be the best place.
Great. And you're Nikki Black on Twitter, which it's always, you have a very fun and active Twitter stream with great information and also great cuisine.
Thanks so much. I try.
Frequently am hoping for an invite over for dinner, but that would involve a lot of travel. So maybe sometime in the future. We've been chatting about, since you're an active social media user and a lawyer who is actively involved in all kinds of cases, what do you think about the notion of having your initial salvo where there's some sort of legal right that's been infringed, violated, and you need to convey to the other side that they're going to stop or other things are going to happen that they might not like? How do you feel about doing that via a Facebook message or a DM or at on Twitter?
Well, I think the most of the cases, it talks about whether you can actually get through to the person in some other way. And if you can't, I think that it makes sense to allow at least initial contact through social media, especially assuming the person somehow responds. But if there's no other way to get a hold of them and you've tried all alternate means, then I don't see why that wouldn't be an acceptable method. It's another way to contact people. I mean, I don't think of social media. We talk about this in Carolyn Elephant and I wrote a book about social media for lawyers. And when it comes to, for example, the ethics case dealing with judges friending people on Facebook and any other type of social media communication, I don't think social media is any different from any other form of communication. I don't think it should be treated differently. And if the difference is sending a fax and you can't get a fax number or contacting someone through social media, I don't see why that's particularly different. I don't think it should be treated all that differently. It's just an extension of other ways that we communicate. Shouldn't be the first way that you try to contact somebody. You should try and find alternate, more traditional routes, but you end up at social media, you end up there. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing.
Jonathan, you seemed like you were trying to get a word in edgewise here. Final thought?
Well, Evan said that you could not send a DMCA via Twitter, and I agree. But I still had to make a run at it. And in fact, I decided to create my very first haiku in recent years, my C&D haiku. Infringing copy, please cease and desist at once, notice at link. And I've still got 70 characters left to include a short URL or two.
It's wonderful. I think that's going to join in with our other tip of the week for if you want to give a cease and desist notice under the DMCA on Twitter. So thanks so much for that. While we've been chatting about this, the topic of cease and desist letters, Spartacus in the chat room sent me a link for something one of our former guests on Twill has posted over at Engadget. Neelai Patel has a story about AT&T warning customers that emailing their CEO will result in a cease and desist letter. This reminding anybody of the story about the judge we were discussing last week where the judge held someone in contempt for having a bunch of his followers email the judge. Here, the head of AT&T apparently is unhappy that one person has been emailing. And let's see what is going on here. Basically just, expressing displeasure with something we're going to talk about on the show, AT&T's new data rates. So he's just sending some complaints to the CEO. And unlike Steve Jobs, apparently Randall Stephenson doesn't want to just fire back a pithy response. He's going to all he's threatened here is a cease and desist letter. I don't know that that's necessarily a huge threat. Okay, so send out your letter.
He's apologized, apparently. The AT&T apologized.
Well, good. Good, good. I'm glad to hear it.
They got a lot of bad PR and they apologized, so.
Great. Well,
back
good
against
for you.
The wall.
Good for you. Randall, you might want to consider actually responding to some of those emails. You might wind up having a better PR impact.
Yeah. Because
ahead,
Steve Jobs only responds to a very small percentage of all the email he gets, yet look at the PR boost he's gotten. He only sends like one or two words every time. He's probably put like a total of 10 minutes of his day into his email, and everyone thinks Steve Jobs is so awesome because he responds to his email. It's incredible.
Well, he did have a lengthier response to the writer over at Gizmodo.
Yeah, that's true.
I want to get into those iPhone issues in a bit. But first, Evan, you sent in an interesting link about the legal semantic web and doing more things in an automated semantic way that have legal impact. You want to go ahead and expound on that?
Well, sure. We've talked about the semantic web and semantic technologies on the show quite a bit before, and anybody who's a regular watcher or listener of the show knows that I'm quite a fan of these technologies, just because I think they're so cool, even from a philosophical level. I'm not so much a technologist, and I don't understand all the workings of RDFA and how ontologies are implicated, or how they're implemented, I guess is the word I'm looking for, from a technological basis. But I just think it's so intriguing to consider how data across the web can be encoded so that its meaning is presented in a way that it can be picked up by machines. And it really is a wonderful innovation for web users to be able to find and compile content in a rather automatic fashion just by the way that data are encoded so that their meaning is made more explicit rather than being so implicit and requiring a human. So the link that is in the discussion points for today is really a very concise notion or treatment of how Creative Commons can serve, or the Creative Commons framework can serve for a substrate for the semantic web to really play out in a very pragmatic way that in kind of the neighborhood that we think about. There's an expression language, the Creative Commons Rights Expression Language, which is a way of encoding data and describing data so that the licensing status of pieces of content out there on the web, objects out there on the web, can be well known. And I'm just really excited to see the discussion of this technology in the context of, enthusiasts about the semantic web. This is on semanticweb.com, which is a clearinghouse for a bunch of information about semantic technologies. And it was very pleasantly surprising to see a discussion of, this notion of the legal semantic web. So
how does this work in practice? Because I get the notion that that you would embed your Creative Commons information. So if there's a specific license that's applicable to an item that's going to be shared on the web, somewhere in the course of the link, that information would be contained and a browser could pick it up and see that, this photograph or this bit of text is licensed in this way, and it could convey that message. But the use case that's written about here is kind of interesting. It's called Thingiverse.
Yes.
At thingiverse.com, Thingiverse, a place to share digital designs that can be made into real physical objects. So I guess what's being licensed here is the design itself, not the object.
Right.
And what you're seeing here are a bunch of photographs of things that could be made from these designs. I was kind of thinking it would be hard to embed it into the object itself, but that's not what they're doing here.
Right. Now, this is, I mean, Thingiverse is you know, to connect people with designs and the entities that will create those physical things. And, I mean, we've got to remember when we're talking about semantic technologies, we're talking about the meaning of data. You know, semantics is you know, a discussion of meaning. And so it's the implication of these, I keep using that word, but I mean to say the implementation of these technologies helps meanings kind of translate across different contexts so that if you're looking for something, your search doesn't have to match up exactly with the keywords that would necessarily hit. You could be talking about, February 14th, and then a semantic type of engine would know that you're talking about Valentine's Day, even if you weren't, discussing that explicitly. It's when implicit meaning can be made more explicit. So I really, am intrigued by the ways it can be used, for example, on Thingiverse, thingiverse.com, to connect and link disparate pieces of data like this. But then the discussion on semanticweb.com that's in our discussion notes also talks a bit more speculatively about how this could be expanded even beyond the current day use of Creative Commons encoding. It speculates and talks about what if information were out there, particularly within transactions between entities, that would designate information about the status of a non-disclosure agreement or some other kind of contractual agreement. I forget the other examples, and I don't have it right here in front of me now. But this type of automation of meaning within data and documents that relate to a transaction could be a lot of the grunt work, so to speak, could be taken care of machines that are looking at these ontologies, looking at the meanings of these disparate bits of data and making sense of that, taking a lot of the effort away from the humans and probably effort from the lawyers as well.
Right. Jonathan, you do a lot of work and study on making sure that things are being used with permission when they're being used, or actions that can happen if they're not. Have you seen this play out at all in your journeys around the web?
This idea of the semantic, unfortunately, no, it's not that common yet. And this is something that's very frustrating. Anyone that's clicked through a terms of service agreement for any site, I mean, I think iTunes has something like a 36-page terms of use agreement or something like that. I don't think most lawyers take the time to read that. We need this idea of this simplification, this way to make things easier. And I really found this article extremely interesting when I first read it in the show notes. I mean, this really was a head-slapping moment. Why limit this to copyright? Why not expand it to everything? You know, you could have sites, say, like, you know, Facebook, a good way to, you know, deal with their privacy issues. We set up a stock privacy license to say this is licensed underneath your Facebook privacy license or the Facebook standard TOS version 2.0 or something like that. And that way you read the license once and you simply know what it means when you see the name again.
That would assume that the policy is not changing on a weekly or biweekly basis.
And that's one of the things that would be very different is because with Creative Commons, for example, this is the current best example, you have different versions of the CC license. It's changed at least in slight ways over the years. So what we have is a system that has evolved slowly, but not like the Facebook license where it just changes, you know, bing, arbitrarily, we've got a new privacy agreement. Hope you like it because you're stuck with it now. It's different than that. It would require more planning, more thought, more attention be given to every iteration of these licenses, and that would be another huge element of it. I really am fond of this idea, and it was, like I said, reading this article, it was a real hallelujah moment for me because I think this could be applied to any number of things. They mentioned in this article, for example, non-disclosure agreements. Or it was an interesting idea. You know, this is you agree to be under NDA v2.0, whatever, having the cute little graphic like with Creative Commons and so forth. I think it could be a very handy thing to simplify the web because know, the bitter truth is most people are not well-versed enough. I mean, I consider myself pretty fairly legally minded. I'm not an attorney, but I spend way too much time reading legal documents for my own health. But even some of the language and some of the licenses confuse even me. You know, I don't know how people with no legal experience would ever understand a lot of these terms of service and these other agreements. I mean, I'm constantly getting freelancers, for example, asking me to please review the agreements that they're about to sign because they don't understand them. And this is going to be a crucial element. We do need to see more of this.
Yeah, I think you've just struck on a new business model, and we should go out there and start shopping it to investors because it sounds like a good one.
Quick, get a patent. Someone get a patent.
Seriously, well, what we're talking about here is a way to both standardize agreements and put them under user control. Or perhaps a little bit more under user control than they are now. Maybe not entirely because it wouldn't be the users drafting the agreements themselves, but it would be the users selecting, presumably, the ones that they liked or disliked, bought in on or didn't buy in on. And of course, you could involve the whole social media arena of the web in commenting upon and vetting and rating the various options that were available out there. So I kind of like this concept, Jonathan. Nikki, what do you think?
Well, I think it would not be a very popular concept with the lawyers. isn't this another variation of people doing things for themselves? Reminds me of the idea of the online legal forms that people can create for themselves rather than hiring a lawyer. And this sounds like putting the power into the hands of the people. So I would expect that if something like this were actually, they were attempted to be implemented, there's that word again that Evan keeps hanging his hat on, might end up getting a little, you might end up with a little bit of an uproar. I'm not sure that I think it's a good idea, but I have a feeling that it would encounter quite a bit of resistance.
But yeah, it's sure it would at a certain level, but there's also still plenty of work for the lawyers to do in, you know, looking at the larger scale legal issues and thinking abstractly and conceptually about, you know, how, for example, liability should be allocated. The semantic technologies could easily help in the administration side of these things and a lot of the drudgery. So maybe it's really the paralegals and the contract administrators who would be under attack by this. On a different note, a related note, I mean, I see a tremendous potential for the use of semantic technologies, you know, within the practice of law. And I think I've talked about this before. For example, in legal research, you know, one of the things that we do as attorneys when we are writing a brief, you know, advocating a position, is we of course look to precedent, and we read cases and you know, we read statutes and we read cases that interpret those statutes. And what we are doing is we're engaging in a cognitive process of taking you know, to use a web kind of term, you know, we're taking objects such as, you know, holdings and findings of fact and, you know, the things that the court says and links among those things between, say, for example, a factual scenario that gave rise to a holding here, a conclusion of law here, a different factual scenario over in this object that gave rise to a different order, a different conclusion of law over here, and we're engaging in a biological semantic type of analysis when we are taking our present factual scenario that our client has given us, and we're looking to stare decisis and implementing meanings from these other things here. If we could undertake the very it would be quite an elaborate project to encode all of the data that are out there in all of the cases that have come down from the courts and all the statutes and things like that. But if we were to able to encode all that data in a certain way, it would really enhance not only the accuracy with which we could make legal arguments and draw tighter analogies to previous court decisions, but it would also speed up that process as well. Making the practice of law much more efficient and to the benefit of our clients.
Well, I think all of this sounds like a great concept, and Creative Commons certainly wasn't very well received when it first rolled out by a whole lot of folks. We're sort of wondering whether one size fits all agreements would be feasible or a good idea, and whether folks would understand them well enough to have the whole framework work in practice. And it seems like it's chugging along just fine. So, you know, I could see that being a model for other areas of the law as well. And I think that there certainly would be a welcome sigh of relief from the internet community and the community at large who want to have these issues simplified. So who knows? Let's see what happens on that front. On the front of disclosing when you are being given a perk or some sort of gift or payment in exchange for writing or podcasting about something, you may recall last winter, the FTC issued some guidelines that require disclosure when you're in that situation. And most of the time, I see this discussed in the context of what the blogger or the podcaster, the person doing the writing or expressing must do, how they must disclose their relationships with people who are supporting their activities, especially, you know, and particularly when they're writing or talking about that particular item. So what we have now is the very first opinion discussion from the FTC itself under those rules. And unfortunately, it doesn't seem to have shed a whole lot of light on how the rules are actually supposed to work, because it paid a whole lot of attention to what the product provider, in this case, Ann Taylor, the clothing store, was providing, and their actions, and suggested that they might be actually liable for not making sure that that the bloggers themselves made the proper disclosures. So there's an extra level of responsibility that's being suggested here. If the blogger doesn't disclose, you know, what does the advertiser then have to do? Have you guys taken a look at this? And do you think that maybe the FTC is going too far here? Jonathan, what do you think? Jonathan,
honestly,
there?
With this one, oh, I'm here. Sorry. I was just mulling for a second there. I do that from time to time, unfortunately. It is interesting. It is interesting how the FTC chose to apply this. I mean, whenever it first came around, I'm kind of surprised it took this long for the first case to come about. I mean, how long has it been? Does anyone remember when the rules were first passed?
It's November or December last year.
Yeah, so it's been about 7 months or 7 or 8 months. So, yeah, it's been a little bit longer than I actually expected, but I guess this is how the FTC moves. But targeting the advertiser, when the rules came about, it seemed like everyone was talking about how this is going to affect bloggers. Because remember, this whole thing was supposedly targeted at that whole pay-per-post scheme, you know, getting the sneaky money to write about and link to things and so forth. And it really was focused on the bloggers that were taking advantage of the system and not properly disclosing. It had little to do with the advertisers themselves. In fact, I don't recall any discussion about liability on the advertisers' part during when the rules were being announced and taking effect. So it seems like a bit of an overreach to me, but I guess we're going to have to see what comes, what the final result is. Or has this
Jonathan
reached the final
just
result?
Had a little Skype issue there.
Sorry,
you froze up for a second. You want to finish your thought?
Where did I freeze up, Adam?
You thought that the FTC had perhaps overstepped.
Yeah, it just seemed like the actual intent of the law, whenever it was being announced, whenever the original hoopla was coming, was to target, like I said, the pay-per-post schemes and not the advertisers behind them. In fact, I don't recall much discussion at all back then of advertiser liability in these cases. So it kind of came as a surprise to hear this would be so targeted at the advertiser and they'd be interested in those issues.
Well, my recollection of reading the guidelines was a little bit different. And okay. You know, I haven't looked at them since, you know, November 25th, probably because they went into effect on, December 1st. But, you know, when I heard about this, and actually I'm not clear what actually happened with Ann Taylor. I didn't go and you know, read whatever came down from the FTC, and I couldn't glean it from this article in the show notes, which was on The Blade by Ron Shannon, MVP. I'd never heard of that, but I'm sure it's looks like it has something to do with Chris Perillo, right? Mm-hmm. My recollection in reading the guidelines was that bloggers should read a sigh of relief because the FTC was actually going to place most of their efforts on the advertisers. And that seemed to make the most sense to me because those are the ones really who are in the place to do the most harm by unscrupulous efforts, you know, going out you know, preying on the innocent blogger who may or may not know what's proper or what's not. And plus they have the deep pockets to pay any kind of fine under this, and also to, you know, stopping the unscrupulous conduct on the part of the advertisers would kill off the potential for a lot of this stuff going on. So I guess it warrants rereading those guidelines again.
Yeah, and, you know, and honestly, I don't remember it either, and I read it from blogger's eyes, so it's very possible, actually, I was focused in on the wrong parts.
Yeah, and, you know, the fact that it's been 6-7 months or whatever, you know, just tends to underscore what I said back in November, December. The sky is not falling on this. No. You know, I was surprised to see some very smart people say that these FTC guidelines were the, you know, biggest legal development in technology in 2009. I'm like, what are you smoking?
What?
I mean, it's not a big deal.
So, what?
Oh, yeah. Were you one of those? I was actually thinking
of... I kind of wrote them off too because, I mean, I understood that it was something to keep an eye on, but I didn't think it was that huge of a deal when they first came out. I kind of downplayed it too. I mean, it was something that was worth tracking from a mass media law perspective, but certainly not the biggest development in 2009.
Right. I mean, yeah. I'm actually calling out Professor Goldman, who, you know, I respect more than you know, anybody on the face of the earth, you know, when it comes to law and technology, you know, and I think he had a list of the top cyber law developments of 2009 and put this near the top of the list. So, you know, that's who I had in mind when I was saying this. And so, you know, I still think this is something that we got to be conscientious about. We got to remember that these are just guidelines. These are not new rules. These are not new laws. There's no new statute here. These are just, you know, guidelines issued by the FTC saying how they intend to effect their power to make sure that there are no unfair and deceptive trade practices going on out there.
It's something to be aware of and not lose sleep over is what I would say.
Yep.
One thing I think is really interesting about it, and this sort of goes back to, this is more of the big picture, more about when these went into effect, but it goes back to the idea of treating online commerce or online journalism differently than the real world. There's always this demarcation. I feel like they're treating things differently and they're not allowing bloggers, or they're making it more difficult for bloggers to profit. And also sort of, I think that this policy of going after Ann Taylor sort of discourages the companies from providing bloggers with compensation for writing about these things. Do I think bloggers should be getting compensation? I don't know, but does it happen in the real world all the time? Yeah. And is it something that people are forced to disclose? No. So it just seems to me that there's like this double standard where, once again, online interaction, online commerce is treated differently than what's going on in the real world. And this just sort of seems to me evidence of that continuing trend.
Yep. The FTC and Steve Jobs tend to view bloggers through skeptical eyes. So let's see. Let's move to other people who can view the internet denizens through skeptical eyes, the music/Hollywood/entertainment industry. We have a few things to talk about on that front. Number one, Ben Schefter, who's a copyright lawyer and blogger, has a good write-up of a Supreme Court petition for review, which is how you go about asking the Supreme Court to take a look at your case regarding the innocent infringer rule. This is in one of the many PP cases out there, and it involves whether or not you can reduce the copyright damages, which can be so enormous, as we've seen in lots of the cases we've talked about on this show, if you are an innocent infringer. And the way that this sometimes comes into play, and the way that the party arguing in this case it should come into play, is if you have not, if the product that you have infringed, it does not bear a copyright notice. And the reason it's pretty interesting here is because, of course, when you are engaging in P2P file sharing, none of the digital files that you're touching are going to actually bear a copyright notice unless they do so in some sort of semantic way that we haven't yet seen come about. But typically the way the music industry conveys their copyright notices is on a CD, a physical CD that you would order or purchase in a store. So when you're bandying various digital files that have been ripped from those CDs about, of course, they're not going to have a copyright notice on them. And so, you know, you may arguably have the opportunity to assert this innocent infringer defense and reduce your damages. But it seems like a context where it might be ridiculous to think that you're actually going to have that notice accompany the item that is the subject of infringement. Jonathan, you have any thoughts on this?
You know, I have to agree with Ben Schaffner on this one, in that if we say that it has to come with a notice, I think that the attitude the appeals court took on this one was that the record labels did everything in their power to ensure that there was proper notice given on these works. They put the notice on the CD, and I'm sure they put it on in some format, whether it's in the terms of service or somehow included it with digital distribution that's legally acquired. They did, you know, everything that they could within their power to ensure that proper notice was given. Now, someone at some point ripped the CD, they removed the DRM from a digital download, whatever. They somehow obtained the file and then distributed it in a way that, you know, does not have that notice. Does that mean that the record labels, you know, have their damages significantly reduced because everyone's essentially an innocent infringer on peer-to-peer? I think the appeals court essentially kind of said, no, that's not fair. The record labels did their part, and you know, they should get the damages that they deserve, so to speak. That was the appeals court standing. Obviously, the district court disagreed. The appeals court was overturning the lower court ruling in this one. And I should have really been there for this one because this took place in the appeals court 2 miles from my house. I feel like a jerk for missing it. But
it's always fun to go hear those arguments when
I should have been there. I mean, if I had known about it in advance, I would have lined up and at the door, had my ticket ready, my little foam finger and everything. It would have been great. But no, I missed it. And but I think in this case, the situation is, and I think what the appeals court wanted to avoid was a situation where essentially all peer-to-peer file sharing would have that innocent infringer status. And I think the appeals court just simply did not feel that was the right way to go about it.
Yeah, unless you could establish that it was the person who had actually, you know, taken the physical thing with the notice on it and ripped it and put it out there. Yeah, I think that's where you would be left. Apparently, though, according to the cert petition, there is a split. It didn't seem like any court had specifically addressed this particular issue, but there's enough of a split in the circuits on the innocent infringer rule that this could go up to the Supreme Court. So unfortunately, the Supreme Court only takes a tiny, tiny fraction of the things that it is petitioned to take. So we'll just have to watch and see if that actually pans out. Evan, do you think this one's interesting because of the way it plays out in the digital realm?
It is interesting, and it's one of those where you can easily articulate both sides of the dispute. You don't want a bright line rule that says just because something is distributed in a medium that doesn't lend itself well to bearing a copyright notice, that means, therefore, automatically any subsequent copying of that is going to be an innocent infringement under the Copyright Act, and therefore less than, or, you know, a lower level of statutory damages. At the same time, a situation like this where you have the girl who was 16 at the time of the alleged infringement, I imagine there was some very good advocacy done at the district court level to show that she met this standard that's in Section 504 of the Copyright Act, which says that you know, where the court finds that such an infringer was not aware and had no reason to believe that his or her acts constituted an infringement of copyright, then the court can not find that there was no infringement that took place, but the court can then find that statutory damages can be no less than $200 per work rather than $750 threshold there. So we had some facts here that probably lent themselves well to arguing that this this girl wouldn't have known that this infringement went on. But that's dangerous from the you know, the very strong copyright ownership view, the proponent type of view that that you would take, Jonathan. You know, having this very bright line rule, that that's very dangerous. Because then what are we saying? Every digital distribution, everything subsequent to that is going to only is not, you know, is going to be potentially subject to less less statutory damages. That's dangerous.
And I do agree that there are elements of this case that do lend itself to an innocent infringer claim, but I think there are also elements that are fairly unique to this case. LimeWire was a service that, and I actually recently had a conversation with a good friend of mine who I had to break the bad news to them that LimeWire was not a legal way to download all their music. It was quite a heartbreaking moment, actually, to have to break this news. LimeWire did take action on their part to make themselves appear more legitimate. I could see how people would get that impression that it was a legit service. And, of course, with their recent defeat in court, how much longer they'll be around, anybody's guess, but that's not the point. It's fascinating how, you know, people do believe that, but I think it was not supposedly this wide, bright line situation. I think the facts of the case that lend itself to innocent infringer were more unique to this situation, the age of the defendant, the exact situation of how she was downloading the music, where she was getting it from. I think those elements play more to bear than whether or not there was a copyright notice affixed to the work.
Yes. Yes.
Let me run this idea by you folks. Now, none of this is required, but obviously the music industry has a strong interest in tracking its files as they are traded around through peer-to-peer and wherever else they may roam. And there's watermarking. There are digital fingerprints that can be, as we were talking about, electronically inserted. Why not, echoing our former discussion on semantic web and data that travels along with digital information, why not have some requirement that if they are going to convey an adequate notice that makes any sense in this arena, that there be some sort of digital notice of copyright? Do you think that that's going too far? Do you think a court would take that step? What do you think, Nikki?
By digital notice, you mean that I'm not sure what...
Well, like we were talking about with Creative Commons a little while ago, you can encode in the digital file the licensing information that goes along with the object in question. Why not encode in a song file on a CD such that it would travel when it was ripped and then traded around? Something that would alert a browser or bit of software that is playing or processing that file, that this is a copyrighted item, and convey that notice.
And I wouldn't be surprised if they couldn't somehow remove that from the digital product. You know, once I would think that's what would happen if you put that on there, is they'd eventually find a way to remove it. Because they can be quite creative that way, in my experience. So I think that, but that might be a better way to at least show that the music production companies are doing their part to put it out there. But I think it eventually would get removed one way or another.
It wouldn't. You certainly see copyright notices in, you know, the ID3 tag, you know, which is the metadata that goes along with most sound files, and you know, it can be associated with a file when you're ripping it off of a CD. But what I gather, Denise, you may be talking about something that's actually encoded within the data that would be a little bit harder to strip out, right? Something that's actually within the bits, like a hash value, akin to a hash value, or something like that.
Like Paul speaking backwards.
Right. He's the walrus, after all. I mean, the issue with that is it would seem that we would need to have a lot of efforts going into standardization so that those bits of data that are encoded in there in this non-strip outable kind of way, you know, something, you know, more embedded than an ID3 tag would be, we would need to be doing some development so that those bits of data are then translated and actually rendered as a copyright notice. And that seems like we're really getting into some kind of theoretical stuff there. And in any event, it would seem like there would always be a way to circumvent that if you were going to encode it in a different format, or if you were even to take such the drastic, you know, quality reducing measure of making an analog copy of the digital file, you know, running it out of the sound card or out of the USB, and making it a separate copy, I guess out of the sound card is how you would make an analog copy like that, that would thereby strip out even that very well embedded code. But that doesn't mean that you know, just because we're sitting here identifying all the issues with it doesn't mean that there are some wonderful things conceptually that I think, you know, should be on the horizon and probably indeed are on the horizon when it comes to this copyright management technology that smart people are thinking about. The other quick point that I would have on this is it would seem that, you know, as much as we hate DRM, or we talk about how much we hate DRM and the way it can get in the way, Jonathan, you may feel differently about this. You know, we talk about, you know, that irksome part of the DMCA under Section 1201. I guess it's under Section 1202 of the Copyright Act, part of the DMCA that talks about the removal or alteration of copyright management information. So I got to thinking along those lines, Denise, when you were talking about having that encoded copyright information, if somebody were to strip that out, we would be in that very treacherous landscape of the area where maybe somebody would find themselves liable for something under the Copyright Act that is not being liable for copyright infringement. And I think to most thoughtful people, there's a certain sense of dissonance when somebody finds themselves in that type of situation. So yeah, it's neat to think about this.
Here's where I get the dissonance is, you know, I mean, granted, there are lots of people out there using P2P networks who know very well that they are engaged in copyright infringement, and perhaps the notice is redundant and the innocent infringer reduction shouldn't apply to them because of their own internal intent, mens rea, we would use in the criminal context. But there is a healthy percentage of people out there who, you know, are a bit in the dark about these kinds of things. And they find themselves using a tool that enables them to download something that's copyrighted. And maybe they legitimately have no idea. They're, you know, maybe they have some inkling, maybe they have no idea at all. They just know that their technology does it, it's easy, and isn't this cool, it actually works. And, you know, I think that the kids and by extension their responsible parents who are held liable for their actions fall into that camp, and, you know, just the clueless masses. And I do like the concept of putting the onus on the rights holder to convey in an effective way. And I don't pretend to be able to sit here today and figure out, you know, how something could be embedded and persist. But to figure out a way to convey in a context-specific fashion that this is a copyrighted thing, and there are going to be ramifications that you might not have thought about if you go ahead and download it, use it without having paid and being duly authorized to do so. I don't know how to sort this out, but it does strike me that this innocent infringer thing does have a role here. And even though it may require some hoops to jump through, I don't think we should write it off entirely. I hope the Supreme Court takes this one, actually, because I think it's pretty interesting. Jonathan, what were you going to say?
Just really quickly, I think the problem we have with putting the onus on the copyright holder in this case is that the technologies that are easily viewed by what would be the average peer-to-peer file sharer are too easily stripped off, even by accident. I mean, I've lost my ID3 tags just trying to convert my files to a different format. It's far too easy to have it happen even by accident. And there are technologies. There's a company called Digimark, D-I-G-I-M-A-R-C, that does an invisible watermarking technology. It specializes in images and video, but the technology, I believe, also works on audio, where they overlay information into the data stream that is very, very difficult to remove. It can survive conversion. It can survive resizing. It can survive recoloration. It can survive just about anything. It's a very cool technology, but it requires special readers to access it, and it's not something that your average file share or even your average internet surfer would have at their disposal and at the ready. So how to convey that notice in a way that is both easily viewed and very difficult to remove, I don't think we have that technology right now.
Denise, if I can really quickly, I tend to like to look at the big picture, and I keep coming back to that, but ultimately, I think the copyright they're going after the wrong people. They're going after the young students and the parents of young students for something that's been going on forever. The reason they're going after them is because the technology is changing, and you're able to exchange this stuff on a grander scale. You're able to copy it on a grander scale. But this has been going on forever. When I was in college, and I'm showing my age here, but everyone I knew, not me, of course, but everyone I knew dubbed tapes from each other. I went to the store and purchased them all myself, and everyone dubbed off of me. I certainly didn't do that, but this happened on a large scale in college. No one had the money to buy these tapes themselves. We were college students. We were broke. Everybody dubbed it. And this has been going on from that point on. You know, you couldn't copy albums, but you could copy tapes, and people did that. You had the double tape decks on the boom boxes. And the only reason that it's like they're fighting something they didn't care about before. Now they care because it can be done on a grander scale. And it's really just them resisting change. They're resisting sort of technological change that's occurring. And you can get into all these different specific acts of what's in the in the DCMA and how, who's violating what section of it. But ultimately, the copyright acts need to change because the times are changing and the laws aren't changing with them. And that's a big problem with technology across the board.
Yes, and Denise, what I would suggest in response to the sentiment you're expressing about, hoping that the Supreme Court takes this up, this innocent infringer question, I would suggest that that the sentiment you're expressing is also a longing for copyright reform, making it more like what the 1909 Act was like than the 76 Act, because of this desire that we all have, or at least. I've used this term already in the show, that thoughtful people have, showing how intellectually superior people who take this position are, who want to see a more robust public domain. We're talking about copyright notice here, and since 1989, it has not been a requirement that a work bear a copyright notice for it to have copyright protection. If something was published before March 1st of 1989, before the Berne Convention Implementation Act went into effect, if it was published without a notice, it fell into the public domain. You can see the analogous kind of feeling here, where we're thinking, well, if it doesn't have a notice and if it can't be conveyed to the user, then the user should perhaps be given a little bit more leniency in the same sense or in the same regard as if they were using a work that was in the public domain. So kind of in tandem with this notion that we're feeling here of wanting this innocent infringement defense to be worked up, so to speak, there's also perhaps this notion of how it would be nice to see the copyright reformed in such a way that it wasn't so easy to lock works up in by copyright, and they could flow more freely into the public domain.
This is sort of a bit of a tangent, but have you noticed, and I'm curious what the chat room has noticed too about their various technologies. Have you noticed that Apple, which started out by including a little sticker on the iPod that this device is capable of playing music that may be subject to copyright infringement and you should be careful not to do that, that sticker, I haven't bought an iPod in a while, but it doesn't seem to have made its way onto, say, the iPhone or the iPad. It seems like Apple's wanting to convey that extra little bit of care to its users is starting to slip away. Anybody purchase an iPod recently, and if they're still doing that?
No, I haven't seen one in a while.
Yeah.
No.
It does seem like we've gotten away from that. It was, you know, just not that this is even a step removed from the rights holder, but, you know, Apple was clearly trying to protect themselves from any sort of contributory infringement sort of argument by saying, hey, we know this device can be used to play infringing material, but you better not be doing that.
It's also been a long time since I've been in my college's computer lab and seen the big poster, you know, the guy in the pirate hat saying, don't copy that floppy. So,
right. You know, well, the other thing, I mean, as Nikki was saying, times have changed and the way people consume music have changed, even though the laws have not. One big thing that has changed is, you know, the iTunes store itself and the fact that there is this legal alternative that is blossoming and serving to supplant a lot of the file sharing and illegal downloading of stuff. And one way that seems to be becoming more and more prevalent is the streaming model, the either by subscription or for free or, you know, various pricing models. I'm thinking of Pandora and other ways that you can connect up your phone or your computer or your internet connected stereo system and get all the music that you would like. Maybe not the particular track, but Pandora is great how it sort of incorporates the genius type function of iTunes and will create mixes for you based on other tracks that you like. But anyway, that business model has certainly changed things, but it's changing day by day. And this week, because AT&T has now announced its data limits, where formerly you could have all you can eat broadband under some of its plans for iPhone, for example, that's not going to happen anymore. And there's going to be limits that actually cost a bit less than the all you can eat. And AT&T says this should be enough for even heavy users. But if you do go over your limit, you're going to, you know, have a small-ish surcharge and there will be notice of this. We're not going to have the iJustine situation where you've gotten a huge bill for something that you didn't anticipate or so they say. But what do you guys think about the impact of reining in the data plans on businesses like Pandora and other streaming music services? Do you think this is going to be a big problem for them, or is Wi-Fi going to continue to develop and be more widely available, and will they thrive nevertheless? Evan, what do you think?
This is one of those things that's going to be a short-term issue for us. I mean, I'm looking at the exponential development of technologies, and you know, now there's a certain type of scarcity that goes along with this that's influencing the you know, the restrictions that AT&T is putting on this. So it's a short-term thing, a short-term throttle down on the development of cloud services. It's an interesting economic issue at this point. So it would be interesting to hear, you know, if we could channel Mike Masnick, you know, from last week's show to hear what he would have to say about this. But also, I mean, we've got Nikki Black on the line and she is spending a lot of time thinking about cloud computing and moving things to the cloud. I think she's working on a book about that stuff. So I'm sure she's got plenty of interesting things to say about, you know, this scarcity of network resources and how that affects the development of the cloud. I think it's short term.
No pressure, Nikki. But what do you think?
Well, no, I think I agree with Evan. What I was just actually writing about today, I'm writing a book about cloud computing for lawyers, and the section I'm on right now is going over Moore's Law and Graves' Law and how Graves' Law is essentially been repealed. Graves' Law talks about how the communications capacity, the broadband, is now open. And that was the big difficulty with cloud computing in the beginning was, you know, you couldn't watch the videos. The internet wasn't fast enough, so the videos would come over really slowly. And now that now we have full access to the internet because we have this broadband access, and that has opened up the doors to actually using cloud services and having them available in a way that we can actually utilize them. So we are no longer limited in that way. The problem is you have only a few carriers right now, and they are sort of blocking things, putting limits on things. They're, you know, AT&T seems to be unwilling to work on their network, and they'd rather just keep reducing and discouraging users from using the network. But that's going to change because, you know, Google's laying I don't remember the name of the project, but where they're laying they're creating broadband and they're creating their own system. And because of that, and there's, you know, Verizon, Fios, and so there's more and more options out there. And once that, sort of the monopolies are gone, it's really going to open things up. So I think that Evan's right. It is a short-term thing, and it's just a matter of getting a little bit more competition in there. And right now we don't have that. So Comcast and Time Warner and, you know, they're the ones offering the cable. But in terms of the 3G service, it's Verizon and it's AT&T, really. And Sprint's sort of in there as well. But once you get more competition, it's going to really change things. And when the technologies change and you actually have the hardware that's laid, it's going to allow...
Sorry? Seems to me like Wi-Fi is already enough of a competitor to AT&T and the services that it provides on its cellular network that AT&T is just kind of shooting itself in the foot here and driving people who demand these services and enjoy these services off the AT&T network.
I bought Verizon connectivity elsewhere. Right, I bought the Verizon MiFi, and I'm glad I did at this point for my iPad and for my computer because I want to have access to both networks. And now that they've announced these new data plans, I think a lot more people are going to start doing that because people are getting mad at AT&T for doing these things when you're locked into them with Apple products. So, mm-hmm.
Jonathan, are you with us? And do you have thoughts on this? He dropped off for a moment here. I think we're going to have to get Jonathan back on. As long as we have a little break in the action here, I do want to thank our sponsor, Audible.com.
I am back.
Oh, good. Jonathan, you're back. I'm going to go to you in a second after we thank Audible. We love Audible. I listen to Audible all the time. And you can too by going to audiblepodcast.com/twill. They have more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature these days, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. There's so much great business-oriented stuff there, and economics and society and everything else. And the book that I wanted to highlight this week that can be yours if you go to audiblepodcast.com/twill and sign up as a new listener, can be yours all for free. Is Bobos in Paradise by, it's by David Brooks, which is an older book. I think it came out in 2004, maybe. Actually, looks like it came out on Audible in 2001. So it's been around for a while, but I remember enjoying it a great deal when it first came out. The author has a new kind of follow-up book out now called Paradise Drive, and I expect we will see that one on Audible shortly. But right now they have Bobos in Paradise, which is a great overview of sort of our stratified society in the U.S. and how those who have enough to be able to give themselves a cushion are fleeing their stressful lives and trying to create sort of an idyllic existence for themselves. And you know, maybe it's perhaps a sort of artificial degree of peace and tranquility, and certainly one that is centered on themselves rather than on the community. So it's very funny and well written, very interesting to check out. There is one little section here about the quote Bobo woman, and I think that means bohemian something. I forget exactly what his coinage there is. As death comes for her, the angel of death comes to her lovely ranch on 150 acres that she has developed for herself and her husband, who likes to make chutney and that kind of thing. How death goes ahead and tells her to stay right where she is, because you know it certainly couldn't be better than heaven. But he does take her Range Rover with him when he departs. So. It's a pretty interesting and biting commentary, and it is available on Audible. So definitely sign up at audiblepodcast.com/twill. That book or any of its other 75,000 plus titles can be yours, and you'll be enrolled in the Audible Gold Listener Program, where you get a credit for one book per month. And it's a great way to pass the time when you're at the gym or driving along in the car. Since we don't have cloud services everywhere, this is a fabulous way to have entertainment in your car or when traveling that it will keep you going for the long haul. So thank you so much, Audible, for your support of This Week in Law. You can also follow Audible on Twitter at audible_com, where they will give you lots more suggestions for stuff in their inventory. So Jonathan, you were going to chime in on this ratcheting back of AT&T's data plans.
Yeah, first off, sorry for getting knocked off. We got some bad weather moving into New Orleans. There was a guy on an ark floating down the street just a few minutes ago. I have no idea what that could mean. But yeah, I found the ratcheting back of the data plans kind of interesting. And I know Ars Technica did an article on it. They asked their readers, which I suppose at that moment included me, to go into their AT&T account and take a screenshot of their current data usage. And I was curious. I hadn't checked in a while. I'm on the unlimited iPhone plan right now. I did it. And I found that the most I've used in a month, and the far back the graphic one, was about 600 megabytes. Think a little bit over that. Certainly a lot, certainly more than what I could do with the $15 plan, but well underneath 30. But I think I agree with Nikki that it makes Nicole here that it makes me very frustrated and very worried about, you know, being locked in with AT&T, and it makes me extremely nervous, especially as more and more data intensive services come online. Because right now I'm not doing any streaming audio or streaming video over 3G. I'm not listening to much Pandora over 3G, for example, but I might want to. And this could severely limit how I use the phone in the future. And that's something that does have me kind of gnawing at my nails a little bit.
I mean, obviously, they can ratchet back their plans whenever and however they like, you know, bounded only by what the market will bear. I've definitely been using the live streaming services on the 3G network. I don't think it will probably impact my use too much because, you know, my primary use of them has been in the home. So that seems to, you know, and that's taken care of by Wi-Fi and doesn't impact AT&T at all. But, you know, I'll go out and take a run. And instead of bringing my iPod these days, I bring my phone and just turn on Pandora and let it go. Fortunately, I'm not that big a runner. So I don't think I'm going to hit up against their limit. But for other people, it could be a real issue.
They raised an interesting issue earlier today. I saw about how it was sort of a bait and switch for the iPad owners that just bought the 3G. And I thought that was, I hadn't really thought about it before, but for those that were planning on doing the 30-day plans, the way it works is you're grandfathered in if you have a current plan. But if you decided, you know, you're not actually activating the 3G on your iPad, but you plan on doing it down the road when you attend a conference or go on a trip, for example, those people, as soon as they activate it, are now stuck with a new plan. But they bought it thinking they would have the past plan. So they kind of did get a bait and switch, I thought.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, they did. So if you did activate and you've been at the, you haven't been, I wonder what they're going to do, I'm trying to say, with the folks who went ahead and activated, but didn't opt for the unlimited plan, have been on the limited, lesser priced plan, $14.95 or whatever it is. You know, so they're in the system. But if they ever go over their limited plan, I assume they're going to be just bumped to the higher limit as opposed to grandfathered into the unlimited. But I don't know that for a fact. Do you, Nikki?
I'm not sure that. I think that was I skimmed over a post this morning and they talked about that issue. And also for the people that hadn't even activated the 3G and were just planning on activating it down the road, that they were really the one that got, you know, bait and switched the most. But then I don't think we know what's going to happen to the other people that chose to go into one plan, and if they want to ratchet it up or if they go over, what's going to happen to them. But it's pretty clear that the people that hadn't activated it but just had 3G and weren't in AT&T system yet are the ones that really are going to get hit the worst. And it doesn't seem fair. They just got their 3Gs in the mail, or they went and got them in the store 3 weeks ago or something? That's pretty unfair, I think.
Yep. Agreed. All right. Well, one thing we've been following along with is this U.S. Copyright Group case against the thousands of BitTorrent downloaders of Hurt Locker. And there was a little blip that I thought Bohr mentioned there that, you know, what has happened there, just to bring folks up to speed, is the Copyright Group is bringing thousands of actions and subpoenaing many ISPs to find out the identities of folks who might have downloaded this movie. Time Warner actually put its foot down and filed an objection or a motion to quash the subpoena, going after its information, wants to modify it a bit so that they are not required to turn over the information all at once, that they can do it in a way that makes more sense for their staffing and is more economical for them. And let's see, the Copyright Group has responded to that and has pointed out that Time Warner is highlighting the fact that it's not a party to this case, but it appears that Time Warner is utilizing this fact to garner public support to the extent that Time Warner's tactics are an effort to protect the privacy of demonstrated copyright infringers and to let the public know that Time Warner is a good ISP for copyright infringers, because Time Warner will fight any subpoenas related to the infringers' activities. It exposes itself to a claim for contributory copyright infringement. So they are out there shaking their grokster sabers, as it will, and saying, hey, you know, if you don't play ball with us, we'll go ahead and loop you into this too. Jonathan, any thoughts on whether this is anything more than an intimidation tactic?
It's definitely an intimidation tactic. The question is whether there's any additional weight to it. I'm still trying to get a feel for how serious the U.S. Copyright Group is in actually litigating these cases. We know that they are out there sending these thousands of subpoena demands. They're out there, you know, filing these Doe lawsuits. And we know that they're sending letters and $1,500 settlement demands. But we haven't actually seen if they're willing to pursue these cases and how far they're willing to go after them. I mean, the RAAA show with the Thomas case and so forth, that they're willing to litigate and they're willing to take these to the net, so to speak. Whether you agree with them or not, at least they were willing to actually litigate them. It's unclear if that's the U.S. Copyright Group's intent or not. So the long story short is, you know, it's definitely an intimidation tactic, but the question is it a serious one? And I think we're going to understand that whenever we see how they handle the people who deny having infringed and choose to fight the U.S. Copyright Group's legal threats rather than just simply fork over the $1,500. But it's going to be an interesting one. I'm looking forward to seeing how this one resolves.
Evan, any thoughts on this?
What else do you expect Dunlap to do? He's got a great racket going on. I mean, he's got a great business model going on here, and Time Warner is standing in his way, you know, by not complying with all these subpoenas. So is he going too far in saying that Time Warner would be a contributory infringer for not cooperating, you know, quickly with the all of these subpoenas? Yes, he's going way too far, because they're not refusing altogether, and they're not saying, hey, we are some random internet service provider that the likes of Pirate Bay can come and be on our system and stuff like that. They're not doing that. They're just saying, look, we've got a business to run here, and that is providing internet service and connectivity to our customers. We're not in the business of running a cubicle farm full of people matching IP addresses to contact information. So he's just doing what, any aggressive, intelligent lawyer in his position would do. I think it's interesting in this, Ars Technica article, it gives a little bit of the background on Dunlap's biography. You know, he's a, after all, he's a silver medalist in full contact Burmese kickboxing. So this guy's not going to be messing around with the likes of Time Warner. He's going to just, you know, smack them upside the head a couple of times and get them to do what he wants them to do, so that they will play into his lucrative business model here.
It seems a bit hyperbolic, if that's a word, to me, to lump in an ISP who, you know, is not trying to run from this. It's just trying to regulate, modify the way that it turns over the requested data, lump them in with the likes of LimeWire and ISOHunt and Grokster. And
And one thing I found interesting that Time Warner said is we also get, you know, recognized, we also get IP subpoena requests from like FBI and so forth. You know, we're getting these requests for serious cases involving kidnapping, murder, child pornography. These cases take priority over your copyright suit. So I think, you know, Time Warner does make a pretty solid case for why they would want to slow down these subpoenas. But I think right now, from looking at the numbers, Time Warner wants to handle something like a few dozen per month. And, of course, U.S. Copyright Group wants several thousand yesterday. So I think what's going to happen at some point is there's going to be some negotiation either through the court or just between the two parties and find out what is an actual reasonable number that can be done. Maybe there's a way to resolve it that way.
Yep. Nikki, any thoughts before we move on?
Well, I think, you know, in terms of the threat of suing Time Warner, you know, talk is cheap. I mean, I agree that it's just them sort of pounding their chest and getting some good, you know, press from it too, some good PR. It certainly doesn't make the firm look bad. And I also thought that the little bio of the lawyer at the end was kind of interesting. But yeah, I've never actually seen someone have that type of thing on their attorney bio, let alone it actually be the focus of part of an article. But in any event, you know, I talk is cheap. Whether he's actually going to litigate against Time Warner's, I don't think that's going to happen. I think Time Warner's dragging their feet right now, and I they're going to have to come to some sort of agreement. Maybe the court will lean on them a little, and they'll come up with some plan that's a little quicker than it sounds like at this point. They'd get them in 2 years at the rate they're going. They'd get all the subpoenas they wanted, so something will come. Right.
Well, this is a good lead into the story by Andrew Orlowski in the Register about the ISO Hunt injunction. Yet another determination that a P2P service had run afoul, like LimeWire, in its recent decision of U.S. Supreme Court's Grokster decision and the standard for contributory infringement. First of all, I put this in because I thought it was interesting that Andrew Orlowski is still around. I hadn't read anything by him for a while, and he's always out there stirring the pot and ticking people off. So apparently he's still doing that by using, for example, the word freecards in this article to describe people using the P2P services. He is nothing if not direct. But what, the reason I pulled this out, I hadn't actually read through the documents, but he had a little tidbit here I thought was fascinating. You know, to be liable in one of these cases, you have to show that you're building your business around infringement, that it's part of your business plan. You assume and hope that your users will, in fact, infringe and use your service to infringe, because that's going to give you a lot more traffic and distinguish you, like the U.S. Copyright Group was arguing about Time Warner, as someone who is friendly to infringement. So one of the things that shot ISO Hunt down here was the fact that it kept, for example, a top 20 TV shows listing available for its users to have. So you would assume that that cable television or network television shows that are available for free on a P2P service, I guess this gets us back to our notice issue, even without a notice, there would be a pretty strong indication that that they are infringing items. But you know what else it had that I thought that apparently the court pulled out and used as a determination here? They had a top searches feature. Now, I don't know how that necessarily goes to infringement, but as I said, I haven't read through all the documents and just wanted to float this one by as a recent development, yet another P2P service bites the dust. Evan, any thoughts on this one?
Well, no, nothing really. I mean, I'd never heard of Andrew Orlowski before, and you know, I was kind of... I don't know him still, and so I don't know if I should be insulting him by saying I was very unimpressed by the way he wrote this article. It seemed to, you know, show a certain lack of understanding of what the court actually said, and maybe I was already tainted, you know, by seeing that he was taking such a kind of a, you know, certain taking a very strong opinion to this as well. I don't. we learned a little bit from the ISO Hunt case, you know, the Fung case, but seems like we learned even more in LimeWire about it. And at the end of the day, we still know that you shouldn't make your business model in encouraging and inducing infringement. We may be a little bit smarter now when it comes to these things than what we were a year ago, but we've still got Grokster to look at, and that's how I think about these things whenever I have clients come in the door wanting to, you know, to push the envelope.
Yeah, but Grokster left the Betamax decision and issue on the table, whether substantial non-infringing uses could actually ride to the rescue of a service like this. If you didn't, you know, have actual indications of building your business model around infringement. And that's why this one stuck out at me, that having a top searches feature, you know, I think that's a fairly neutral thing as far as infringement versus non-infringement. Well, Jonathan?
If that is an element that would be used against a company in these types of lawsuits, then nearly every site that has a search capability is in deep trouble. I mean, YouTube, for example, has a top videos listing. Would that be used against them if some of those videos were infringing? I mean, that could really, you know, be an element in the Viacom YouTube case. I mean, it's not, I'm like you, Denise. I think it seems fairly neutral by itself. I don't see how that would necessarily be used against them.
No, I do think that's neutral. I do. Yeah. It was the TV shows thing that I thought
The TV shows thing is definitely more indicative of the problem with ISO Hunt and why the court came down in favor of the copyright holders in this case. But long story short, it's interesting that was even mentioned in this verdict at all.
Yep. Okay. Well, one other quick Hollywood entertainment related story before we move on, and that is that apparently in Australia, there have been some royalty payments involved in enforcing music that's being played in gyms. And I thought I highlighted this one just because I thought that the result or the consequence was interesting. And that is because the gyms don't want to pay all these royalties to be able to play, you know, popular mainstream music, they're resorting to playing cover songs that they're entitled to play without paying the steep royalties. And they're giving airplay to and exposure to a whole level of musicians that otherwise, you know, wouldn't be their first choice. And it just seemed like an interesting, okay, well, you know, if you're going to do that to us, then we're going to perhaps make a whole new economic level of listenership available, and we're going to give exposure to artists who wouldn't otherwise get airplay, and we're going to, you know, essentially get what we want anyway. We're going to have an alternate Britney Spears, if you will, for people to sweat to on the treadmill. Let's see, Nikki, any thoughts on this one?
Well, I thought it was really interesting. It was not a, I was unaware of that particular law. I don't live in Australia, but I thought it was interesting because, A, it's not having the intended effect. It's reducing royalties for the actual the people that are entitled to them. They're not playing Britney's music, for example. One thing that I thought also was interesting was that they were doing cover songs. Why not just play these other some different music of less popular stars rather than sort of cheesy cover songs? So, I mean, it is interesting that it's giving them some additional exposure, these this other class of musicians, but they're just doing cover songs of Britney Spears and Lady Gaga. Why not play some of their other stuff that is not a cover song? But it seems like it's not having its intended effect. It's actually taking money away from the stars that, or the singers that would be entitled to these royalties. So it just seems like they're shooting themselves in the foot or enforcing this law.
I mean, Jonathan? the problem I think the original musicians have in this case is they have to realize that music, like any other good that you can buy or sell, has a value. And if you force people to buy it, if you ask or force people to buy it through licensing agreements at a rate that they feel is not justified, the cost that cannot be justified, they're going to find ways around it. They're going to find alternative solutions. In this case, you know, they're going to go with cover songs as a way they feel that, you know, it's not worth paying the extra fee to have the original. And it's a pretty creative solution to the problem, if you will. It's the market forces at work here. That's all it is.
And Evan, any thoughts on this one?
Just can't get over how much this must suck to have to listen to those cover tunes, you know, that describe it.
There's really a reason I bring my iPhone to the gym.
Yeah, really hard to get hepped up on this cover of Pink Floyd's Another Brick in the Wall. They describe as the menacing bass line being replaced by a tight synthesizer beat, and the backing vocalist's interpretation of the brooding chorus, "We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control," comes across as cheery. Never before have I ever felt cheery when listening to The Wall. But this would be a first if we go try to, you know, be in good shape in Australia. So that must really be full of stuff.
It might motivate people to actually work out at the gym and, you know, get the work done and get out. So it could be a good thing. It could be a good thing for people's health in the end. I'm just saying.
Yes.
Yes, it's almost as bad as if they had piped in the somewhat internet famous "Everyone's a Winner at Nixon Peabody" song and let folks, you know, sweat to that one. And I bring that up, Nikki, because Nixon Peabody, one of my favorite firms as the result only of that song, is the author of an article about a restrictive covenant, some sort of agreement that a former employee said, you know, "I shall not do these things after I leave your employ." But she was engaged in some social media activities that violated that covenant. Tell us about this and why you think it has far-reaching effect.
Well, I'm not sure if it actually has far-reaching effect, but it's an interesting case. And it's interesting how I even came to learn about it was through social media, transferred over to reality. Someone that I actually met through the Rochester Social Media Club approached me yesterday at Starbucks to tell me about it. And his wife had forwarded this on to him, so he forwarded it on to me. It's an interesting case basically because somebody left their employment, signed a non-compete agreement, and then went and approached people they weren't supposed to approach via LinkedIn, connected is what you do on LinkedIn, connected with these people. And if that had been all that had happened, I'm not sure that this case would have been litigated. But then there were apparently some communications over LinkedIn where that may have amounted to solicitation. So well, what I thought was really interesting about it, though, was it brought to mind it's this idea of how when things go online, it's somehow different than offline activities. If you leave a company and you just have lunch with somebody, or you call them on the phone, or you run into them and, you know, at the grocery store, that doesn't violate a non-compete agreement. And I sort of think that connecting with someone on LinkedIn is akin to that type of activity. And it brings to mind, referred to this earlier, there's a case in Florida where judges are not an ethics decision that said judges can't friend attorneys that appear before them on Facebook and other social networks because it's the appearance of impropriety. Obviously, you're talking about different standards in terms of a judge and the appearance of impropriety versus violating a non-compete agreement. But even so, it's still the same concept. Judges have lunch with people. They golf with attorneys. So being connected with them on a social network, I don't think rises to the level of the appearance of impropriety. So I think that Florida decision was decided incorrectly. And, you know, this case is being litigated, the one with the non-compete issue.
Right. What did the former employee actually do?
Well, they friended 30 people that were, by definition of the non-compete agreement, people they weren't supposed to contact, other contract employees, I guess. Or not friended, connected with them on LinkedIn. But then there was some sort of email or LinkedIn message that was sent. And I think that's going to be the nail in the coffin for the case, for the employee, for the person being sued, the former employee. And quite frankly, if someone else wants to read it, I don't quite understand. It's almost like they're speaking a different language, these two people, and they were communicating on LinkedIn, but somehow it rose to the level of solicitation, according to the, the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. But I think, but for that communication between the LinkedIn communication, if it had just been an issue of them connecting on LinkedIn, I don't think that would be as strong of a case. but there was this LinkedIn communication talking about some sort of opportunities. Let me know if you want to pursue them. And the guy responded. And so that was sort of the smoking gun in this case. So, right. And when you transfer that, if you send someone an email saying the same thing, that probably would be a violation too. So I think that actually it is a good, in this case, you know, what we do in reality, sending a letter, sending an email, leaving a voicemail, and the message on LinkedIn, in all those situations, that would probably be a violation. But had it just been friending or connecting on a social network, I'm not so sure.
Yeah, there's a couple of points that I picked up when I saw this, and I actually blogged about it, back on April 5th, if you want to go to internetcases.com and find it. The one thing is, I didn't see anywhere in the complaint as to when they, the sequence of events when all this stuff happened, when she actually connected with those people. And then the exhibits then really are what the bad stuff is, where there's that communication between the defendant and someone else. What that shows to me is that it's particularly a sensitive situation given the industry that the defendant was in, that she was a recruiter, working for a headhunting agency. And that's, among all industries, that's one that has a lot of trade secrets and a lot of information that an employer plaintiff would want to, be the subject of a restrictive covenant. So given that particular context, I can see why the plaintiff would be pretty upset in all of this. But then again, the only reason we're sitting here talking about it is because it involved LinkedIn. If this was any old other restrictive covenant case, we wouldn't have any interest whatsoever if it was just taking somebody to lunch or whatever. It's intriguing because it's LinkedIn. Gives us something to hang our hat on.
Yep. Jonathan, any thoughts on this before we move to something else?
I'm just looking forward to the court getting educated on this one myself. Okay, Your Honor, see, there's a service called LinkedIn, and it's going to go downhill from there. I can just tell. It's going to be great.
Yeah. Maybe that's one where you could go and listen to the arguments. And
yeah, I think I would really enjoy that. I have to bring some popcorn, though.
Yep. Hey, Nikki, you had a blog up, I'm assuming it's still up, that was following along with the developments in the lost/stolen iPhone case involving Gizmodo and Apple. And I just wanted to, we've had some on-the-record comments from Steve Jobs, both in email about all this with an employee of Gawker Media, and also at the D conference earlier this week. And we have the link. Actually, I don't think I stuck it in the show notes, but it's over on our Facebook page for the show at denisesowell.net/FB. The link to some of Steve Jobs' video from D. And he basically said we weren't going to let this slide. It was the kind of thing where we needed to go ahead and pursue it. And Nick, just since you were following the case so closely, I wondered if you could give us your insights about where things stand now and just your take on the overall warrant and search.
Happy to. I started that blog more almost as a place to just put my thoughts down because I was discussing in different social media forums and I wanted to have all my thoughts in one place so I didn't have to keep typing the same thing over and over. And it's a little bit defunct at this point because since the warrant was served and not a heck of a lot has happened in the case, at least publicly. But, ultimately, I think I hadn't really looked at the warrant. I hadn't really gone into that issue. So I don't know if I can comment on that. I hadn't examined that particularly thoroughly. But I think that what I was really interested in was I write a book for Thompson West on substantive New York criminal law. So I'm interested in the substantive elements of different crimes. So that's what I was really focusing on in this case was whether the alleged actions of the different participants amounted to violations of different California statutes. And the smoking gun to me in this case, which someone pointed out to me, L. Frankenstein on Twitter, pointed out to me, another lawyer, was that they knew the person's Facebook name. They seen the person's Facebook account that owned the phone. And up until that point, I hadn't really paid attention to that fact. But I do think that when you're actually looking at the criminal elements of this case and the crimes that these people could have possibly committed, the fact that both the original finder of the phone and that Gizmodo also knew the name of the person. There was a Facebook account on that phone. And they knew the name of the person that owned the phone. Even if they couldn't find that person in the phone book, how hard is it to send them a message on Facebook? So the fact that they knew who that person was when I analyzed these different statutes really was something that was the smoking gun for me. When you step back and look at the broader picture, why is Apple doing this? You know, I love Apple. I have, you know, so many Apple products, it's ridiculous. And I'm a Apple fan girl, fan boy, whatever it may be. Well, I'm a girl.
I'm pretty sure you're a girl.
Whatever the term, whatever the appropriate term is. You know, he's got a lot of vendettas and he's got a lot of vindictiveness. And I just read a post about, you know, how he's becoming Big Brother. And, you know, this is just, I don't think they ever should have prosecuted in the first place. And he acts in that video like they didn't have much to do with it. I know they did. You know, I think everyone knows that they did. The police wouldn't have gotten so gung-ho, even though it's a sexy case. I still don't think that the police in the prosecutor's office would have gone after this case if you didn't have Steve Jobs back there leaning on him a little. So I just think it's one more example of Steve going off the handle between the Adobe feud and all these other situations where he's had these feuds in the past or people that didn't cooperate with Apple when Apple was smaller. And now he's got a lot more market share, he's sort of using his mic and clubbing people over the heads a little bit. And he's getting a little stubborn, which surprises me after his whole, was it a whole kidney problem that he had and he was facing death?
Liver.
Come around a little bit and maybe seen things differently, but I guess not.
So. Boy, he does look skinny, doesn't he? I mean, that's the thing that I noticed. He's really looking gaunt.
Yeah.
Hope he's all right.
Yeah.
I lost a lot of weight. He's on.
In both these video clips that I posted on the show's Facebook page, it's always interesting to see Steve Jobs talk, but one of the points that came across is that Mr. Jobs, much like the FTC, doesn't, you know, necessarily consider bloggers, internet denizens, using social media type instantaneous communication tools as necessarily inherently trustworthy. He made some comments about how the iPad he hoped would prop up the conventional publishing industry and the whole editorial level. And in both that discussion and in his email exchange with the Gawker person, you know, he used blogger in a pretty derogatory way. And you know, I'm starting to feel a bit like a second-class citizen from all this treatment. And I asked the folks on our Facebook page if they agreed that bloggers are legal or ethical dynamite, and whether we're starting to supplant, you know, the Inquirer and its ilk as the untrustworthy, smarmy part of the media. And Nathan Lynn chimed in and said, I think if bloggers want to consider themselves the successors to newspapers, now I think that's, you know, assumes facts, not in evidence. I don't know if anybody necessarily considers themselves the successor, just a, you know, an alternate outlet for information. When it comes to journalism, they need to fully disclose beforehand to the interviewee that they intend to do, what they intend to do with their correspondence. You can't just wait for something juicy to emerge from a series of emails and then decide it's newsworthy. In cases like this, they rank pretty low on that scale. He says, I think that Jobs' point in that exchange was, he said something about believing a bunch of erroneous blogger reports, like it's just, you know, rumor and scuttlebutt that hasn't been verified. Do you guys think that that the citizen journalism layer of the web deserves all of this additional scrutiny and skepticism? What do you think, Jonathan?
Well, some of it certainly does. I don't know about all of it, though. And that's part of the problem is, you know, I think what's interesting is we have some print publications which are very good and very well respected. And then we have, you know, the tabloids, for example. And we have some blogs that are well respected on the web, like Evan Brown's wonderful Internet Cases blog. And then you have Perez Hilton. you know, we have, it's there's good and there's bad. And so maybe, you know, I don't know if there's a way to only scrutinize the bad, but I don't think that there is. I mean, you have to kind of cast a broad brush, but it seems to me that, you know, if you're going to go after citizen journalists for the bad apples, you should do that for all. It just seems the only fair way to me.
Evan, what do you think? Are we a scourge of the web? We people out here who are not aligned. Well, I guess you can't really lump us in with that because I think that Twit is you know, it's not old media, but it's something that is established and has editorial. And, you know, we definitely think about the stuff that we put out. But what about individuals that are not affiliated with some kind of organization? Are they getting a bum rap here?
A little bit, because it's one of those things. There are so many participants in this space and so many different views and so many attitudes and approaches and methods that there's no way that you can generalize accurately about all of them other than to say that they're people, I guess, or that they, you know, use a computer. So
hey, that's not true. Some of them are automated. You know that.
and I did see something where there's something where you're you can put on your cat and your cat can send out tweets now. So
there you go. You see?
Who knows? So, but I'm glad we're bringing this up because I actually wrote a post on my personal blog yesterday, just to give a little plug for that. It's evbro.com, evbro.com, about citizen journalism. And the thing that I was prompted to, the reason that I was prompted to write up that little post was because I was at a hearing at federal court yesterday here in Chicago. My hearing was at 9:30, and so I just, when I came downstairs after talking to the judge, there was, of course, the media circus, because yesterday was the first day of the Blagojevich trial here in federal court in Chicago. So I just waited around and saw the good former governor and his wife make their way from the car. You know, they arrived rather inconspicuously in a white Toyota with temporary tags, and spent about 90 seconds, you know, greeting, is as if he was campaigning. You know, coming into the courthouse, waving, hugging spectators and stuff like that. And so I got to thinking, you know, there I was watching the media circus, you know, the folks from the mainstream media with the big cameras and the TV cameras and the reporters and all that stuff doing their job, doing it well. But there I was, you know, putting up a few tweets about what I was seeing. It really got me to thinking about the way that the information is conveyed and kind of the way that it can be consumed or digested by the end user. And it got me to thinking, making the compare. After I got back to my office was when I started thinking about this, and I wrote up a quick blog post while I was eating lunch, citizen journalism might satisfy the same part of our soul that organically grown food does, because it has the potential of being, and the metaphor that I used in the post to kind of go along with this whole idiom was it can be free from the pesticides of bias and prejudice. It can be. It can also be greatly affected by the pesticides of bias and prejudice. But I was thinking of it more in terms of just being an ordinary guy there. You know, another point that I made in the post was that I was modular and I was able to adapt very quickly. You know, one moment I was legal counsel, you know, I was there in a suit and tie and shiny black leather shoes. But the next moment I was downstairs on my BlackBerry putting up tweets about this, making observations that I thought would be insightful and that, insightful in as much as I was conveying facts that probably weren't going to make it into the mainstream media report about, you know, the temporary tags on the Toyota. We were expecting a black limousine. So I was thinking of it in terms of the ability to convey information and put stuff out there that can paint a more accurate picture in the imagination or the mind of the end user than what does the packaged mainstream media product. And by saying that, I'm not disparaging it at all, because, you know, I want there to be editorial work done by journalists for those things that editorial work should be done on, you know, the inner workings of government and the erudite complex issues that need serious treatment by professional journalists. But there is a definite place for the amateur in this, the citizen journalist. And this all dovetailed very well into a post that this is the second time I'm bringing up in this conversation, Mike Masnick, put up on TechDirt last night, the wonderful alliance that there is in astronomy between the professional astronomers and the amateur astronomers. You know, there was some recent, you know, situation about the disappearing belts of, you know, bands on Jupiter. We can credit the amateur astronomers for noting a lot of those things, and the professionals and the amateur astronomers work very well together. And I think at least between the lines, Mike was suggesting that there can be that same kind of alliance, same kind of integration with professional journalists and citizen journalists, you know, assuming for the moment that there is a fine distinction that, or a true distinction that can be made. There is a certain quality, a certain originality, a certain authenticity that can come from citizen journalism that is not inherent in the mainstream media. Not saying one's better, not one saying worse. I guess what I'm saying is the world is big enough and there's enough information and enough ways for it to be transmitted that we can all participate in some form or another.
Agreed.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And I love your point about astronomy being one of the original fields of study that to engage in crowdsourcing and engaging its enthusiastic public in the actual doing of the science.
Yes.
Go ahead, Nikki.
I was going to say that also raises a really interesting issue that was brought up twice over the last day or two about how the professional media and bloggers, the media doesn't appropriately attribute bloggers when they use information they get from bloggers. There was Eric Turkowitz from New York Personal Injury Lawyer posted about this today, how one of his ideas...
He's the guy who is not the White House blogger, right?
Right, exactly. but he sometimes comes up with some really interesting stuff. And he just posted today about how something he posted, one of his blog posts was ripped off by, well, Above the Law cited him, and then it got picked up by the mainstream media, and eventually the AP picked it up, and he never got cited. He wasn't going to write about it, but then there was another story that I'd also seen, another blogger, not a legal blogger, who posted about how his story got ripped off and he wasn't given any attribution. And so although there may be this synergy or this connection with the astronomers, there is not with the different levels of between the media and the bloggers, the mainstream media and bloggers. And lots of times bloggers don't get the attribution, and yet it does go the other way. Bloggers tend to cite the mainstream media all the time.
Yeah.
Right. Bloggers, we get no respect. but we do podcasts and we do give tips. And Evan, I'm going to let you give our tip of the week, which would be, if you're in California, don't be personating anybody. What does that mean exactly?
I had never heard that word. I mean, clearly we all know about impersonating someone. And there's a statute in California that makes it a crime to personate another. And I blogged about a case that came down from the Court of Appeal there in California this past week. And it's non-citable. It's so wacky out there, you Californians. You can't cite any appellate court authority, it seems like, without there being some. But anyway, it's neither here nor there. But
we have a lot of unpublished decisions.
Yeah. That's so weird. The guy was charged with criminal personation for setting up I think it was a MySpace. It was probably a MySpace page. It seems like it's always MySpace in the stuff.
I thought it was Facebook.
Well, maybe it is. Maybe it is. Yeah. I forget. It was a bogus profile on a social networking site. Maybe we're evolving into the era of doing this on Facebook now. At least it wasn't Friendster. He set up a bogus profile on a social networking site of his pastor, the pastor at the church where he used to go. And not only did he set up the site to, look like it was this pastor, he also put up some status updates or whatever, otherwise posted content through that site that suggested that the pastor was engaging in homosexual activity and that he was using drugs. And so the issue in the case, the defendant moved to dismiss. I mean, I know it's not what it was called. You know, there was some procedural nuance. It was called something different, but it was the equivalent of moving to dismiss. And the court didn't dismiss it. He went up on appeal. And so the issue on appeal was whether or not, you know, he had actually violated the statute, satisfied the elements of the statute for the conduct that he had done. And the court held that, yes, the indictment or the information or whatever it's called in California criminal court was sufficient for this guy to stand trial for personation, because he had set up the profile being someone else, but he had done something else which satisfied the second element of that. And this is where the interesting part is. What he had done was actually was something that would subject the target of the personation or impersonation to some sort of penalty or criminal liability or whatever. So I guess the court's thinking, and this, I don't think this was expressly stated in there, the court's thinking was that could have subjected the pastor, the target, to defamation or to the loss of his job. I think they did mention that in there. So that might be, you know, the penalty under the law that could arise from this personating conduct. So the thing that made it novel, kind of like that Minnesota case that we were talking about with the the LinkedIn profile, the thing that makes it novel is that this is social media. Certainly not the first case under California law under this statute. The court did talk about a couple of those cases, one where personation had occurred, criminal personation had occurred, and one where it hadn't. It did not occur in a situation where a guy was arrested and he gave somebody else's name, like, who are you? I am Jim Jones. And he says, well, is your name, middle name also Ray? Yes. And then, there was really a guy named Jim Ray Jones. I'm making that name up. But that was not personation, because even though he was taking on the persona of someone else, he didn't do something else that would subject him to liability. The another previous case where it was criminal personation is where a woman got arrested for something, pulled over for something, and they gave her a citation. The additional act of signing her sister's name on that citation and therefore making some kind of admission of liability was the extra thing that satisfied that second element of criminal personation. So getting back to making it the tip of the week, just don't do any of these shenanigans in the first place. Don't, you've got better things to do than set up bogus profiles of any sort. But, be mindful of this this framework for liability, at least under California law, of what it means to be potentially criminally liable for that crazy stuff that you're doing on Facebook.
A couple of quick fun stories here at the end. Did you guys see over at Crunch Gear that the Lost finale was now the most downloaded TV show in history? So another statement about letting things out in only a limited way in certain markets. There's going to be BitTorrent riding to the rescue. Here it appears within 20 hours of the Lost finale appearing online. It was downloaded some 900,000 times. So no surprises there. Crunch Gear writes Nicholas De Leon over there. The show's producers did anticipate this and tried to have the finale air quickly after its U.S. debut in other markets, but apparently they weren't quick enough. So it's reminding me, Evan, you're talking about criminal law. Nikki, you practice criminal law. My criminal law professor at Bolt Hall in law school bore a striking resemblance to the actor that plays Desmond on Lost. So if you haven't already seen the finale, Desmond plays a rather prominent role. So there we go. We'll see if anything can come along to topple that. Also, if you're looking to do any dating and you're a P2P file sharer or freetard, as Andrew Orlowski might tag you, there's a dating service for you now. And let's see, let me get you the exact. It's the Pirate Bay, coupling up with Mezog, the social dating site Mezog, to launch an online dating site, piratedate.com. So if you want to, I guess there's an Apple dating site. Why not a P2P file sharing dating site if you want to unify your interest in engaging in nefarious and illegal activities and find a soulmate?
One interesting element, I talked about this on my podcast on Wednesday. We were kind of hem and hawing about it. There's a picture on the front page of a very beautiful woman in a pirate costume. You pull up the Pirate Date site. We got curious about it while we were on the podcast. I took a screen grab of it, and I ran it through TenEye, and I was able to track it out. Apparently, they actually used a legitimately licensed stock photo for the logo. So there you go. I mean, completely kills the Pirate Date mentality to me. I don't know about you guys. That seemed very piracy friendly to me. If they're legitimately licensing their stock photos from Getty Images and iStock Photo,
yeah, it takes the edge off.
It seems a little bit less screw the man.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is a dating site, so
that's right.
There you go.
And for anybody who's waiting with bated breath for the Bilski decision, the business methods patent decision to come out from the Supreme Court, we have certainly been waiting here at Twill, and we are going to do a patent show very imminently that hopefully will encompass Bilski. That's what we're waiting for. So every Monday we keep watching to see if it's come out from the court. That's when they issue their new decisions. And so far, nothing. So we're going to look again next Monday. And if we, in fact, have Bilski in hand, we'll do a show about it and other patent issues next Friday. And I'm going to end by giving you our resources of the week, which both are courtesy of Jonathan Bailey. Thank you so much, Jonathan. I think our viewers / listeners will be interested in both these things. You have a post over at Plagiarism Today called 5 Must Know Copyright Facts for Freelance Writers that I think is a great resource for folks in that arena. You want to elaborate just a bit on it?
Yeah, basically this came about because I had a lot of freelance writers asking me questions, and I decided maybe I should actually target them for once. That's how I get most of my good post ideas, it seems. And basically it's just several to copyright people themselves, the people on this call, they're very basic facts, but they're not widely known by apparently who even in the biz, such as work for hire may not always apply to their work. If you don't have the registration in the U.S., you don't have a lawsuit waiting for you. There are no moral rights protections in the U.S. per se, and so forth. And also that copyright transfers require a signed contract, and that joint authorship can turn extremely ugly extremely quickly if you're not very, very careful with it. And just 5 very basic facts, but it goes into great detail, well, modest detail on all 5. So, yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. And second resource for people to check out over on Twitter, I think these curated Twitter lists can be really, really valuable. For example, Alex McGilvery at Twitter, their GC, maintains an internet law one that is quite comprehensive. Mm-hmm. And let's see, Jonathan, you have one about copyright services. Mm-hmm. And you didn't have too many services listed there, but I assume you're going to add to this.
And I am adding to it and growing it. Right now, it's TenEye, the person behind the Twitter plagiarism service, Safe Creatives on there, iCopyrights on there. And there's a few others that just don't tweet much that are on there, I believe. Yeah, Myos is on there. So, yeah, it's just services that are in the copyright field and are helping out. To provide various detection and enforcement services.
Cool. So if you feel like your copyrights may have been violated or you want to protect them, it's a good idea to check out some of these services and see if they could maybe help you on a go-forward basis. So with that, thanks so much, folks, for joining us for Twill 63. Nikki, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. I enjoyed it a lot.
And dinner's at your house tonight.
Tonight we're going to eat at the pool, I think.
Oh, good, good. Well, I'll look forward at Nikki Black on Twitter to the documentary evidence of it. I'm afraid I may have to just, you know, start posting my poor warmed over Chinese food and that kind of thing as a juxtaposition to the delightful gourmet meals that you're concocting every night.
Cooking's just my hobby. It's the only way I can like calm my mind and not be thinking about stuff constantly, so.
Well, you're an inspiration. Thank you so much for doing that and for all you do. Remind folks again where they can find you online.
NicoleBlackESQ.com. And just to clarify, really, you mentioned a couple times that I practice criminal law, and I do practice very minimally. I'm of counsel to a DWI defense firm, but for the most part, I'm an author. I write a weekly column and I write books. So that's primarily what I do with my days now.
Oh, good. You're a mostly recovering lawyer then. Wise woman. Jonathan, you're not a lawyer at all, but a wonderful writer and podcaster. And thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. And I will be participating for my dinner in Po' Boy Friday, a new Twitter tradition we're getting started with some fellow Louisianans. So there you go. That'll be my dinner.
Congratulations. Wonderful. And good luck down there. You know, obviously our hearts go out to all you folks in the Gulf contending with yet another disaster. So I hope that it manages to work itself out sooner rather than later.
I'm starting to think somebody doesn't like New Orleans. It's really starting to feel that way. It's getting kind of creepy.
It is Pat a bit Robertson. Late. But folks can find Jonathan at plagiarismtoday.com and at plagiarismtoday on Twitter and at the Copyright 2.0 podcast. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Evan, great to have you once again.
Well, thank you very much. I always enjoy a lot being here. So I appreciate the invitation back again.
Well, we enjoy a lot having you, and folks can enjoy a lot Evan's wonderful keeping us up to date on internet developments at internetcases.com and also at internetcases on Twitter. And for anyone wanting to reach me about the shows, I'm Denise at twit.tv for email. I should mention that the shows are going out on video now if you are a subscriber in iTunes and have been subscribing to the audio versions. The video versions, both low and high quality, are now available in iTunes and on YouTube. So we're available on even more devices and in more formats. Do check those out and tell your friends. And you can follow me on Twitter if you'd like. I'm at D Howell. And I put up stuff about the show both at that Facebook link I mentioned, denise.howell.net/FB is the short URL, and at my blog, packingbaggage.com. Thanks all. We'll see you again for Twill 64 next week. Take care.